Welcome to The Point on WCAI. I'm Steve Junker. It's Friday, August 3rd, and this is our weekly news roundup when we discuss some of the top local news stories of the week with colleagues in the print and digital media. Joining me in the studio from the Cape Cod Times is Jeff Spillane. Good morning,
Jeff.
Good
morning, Steve.
And joining us later will be Sarah Tan from WCAI, Bill Evel from Vineyard Gazette. We'll speak with Josh Balling at the Nantucket Inquirer and Mirror, Ed Miller at the Provincetown Banner, Brian Dowd from the Martha's Vineyard Times, and Andy Tomolonis at SouthCoastToday.com. And now a look at some of the news here on the Cape and the Islands. We're going to start this morning by going back to last Friday afternoon and evening. It's when two Falmouth police officers were shot after responding to a call in East Falmouth. This story has unfolded now over the past week. Jeff, let's tell us what we have.
That's right. And as you said, a pretty tragic week here on the Cape started a week ago today with the shooting of two Falmouth police officers, Donald D. Miranda and Ryan Moore. Luckily, both officers are expected to recover fully. But this week, we're learning more about Malik Koval, the suspect in the shooting. He was arraigned Wednesday at his hospital room at Brigham and Women's in Boston on two counts of assault and murder, assault and battery on a police officer, assault and battery with a dangerous weapon, as well as counts of having an unlicensed firearm and resisting arrest. He is being held without bail pending a dangerousness hearing on August 23rd. But what really seems to have captured a lot of attention, we've seen arraignments in hospital rooms before, fairly common, but throughout the arraignment, he was barefoot in a hospital gown, shackled to a bed. He was making hand signals, which caught a lot of attention, described as making a circle with his index finger and thumb and his other fingers upward. Asked about it, Koval said it wasn't a gang symbol, but a lot of people, I think, are disagreeing with that. They're saying it's awful similar to a game called the Bloods. And there were some other things he was doing with his hands there as well. So that was a very interesting component of that arraignment. We're learning more about what actually happened with this suspect prior to the shooting, which was in the Seacoast Shores area of East Falmouth on Ashley Drive. Apparently, the police were called from a report that Koval was breaking glass and yelling obscenities in the street, which brought the police there. His mother and brother were also arraigned this week for assault and battery of a police officer. Apparently, there was a scuffle when the police arrived prior to him going into the house and getting a gun, and they were charged with interfering with the police. We also learned, and it's in today's Cape Cod Times, that this is not his first run-in with the law. In November of last year, he was arrested by police in Westerly, Rhode Island, who claimed that he was either intoxicated or was having some mental health issues. It was some bizarre behavior that he was exhibiting, and it led to a police chase. But he was caught and apprehended about 2 miles into the chase.
So there seems to be perhaps a history of some erratic behavior.
That's what we're finding, yes.
And the officers who were shot, one of them was grazed in the neck, and the other one took two shots.
He took shots, and luckily was wearing a vest, a bulletproof vest, which...
So one of the shots hit the vest, I believe, hit his shoulder, and he's been in surgery
for
that.
And also, it's a lot of the police officers who did travel to Boston for the arraignment went from that hospital room to the officer's hospital room to visit.
Well, very fortunate for the officers and the families there that no one was more seriously injured. Let's speak now with Sarah Tan, joins us of WCAI. Good morning, Sarah.
Good morning, Steve.
I want to talk about a story this week. The owners of Pilgrim Nuclear Power Station in Plymouth have announced that they want to sell the plant after it closes to a company that specializes in decommissioning. Cape Cod Times covered this, as did our reporter Sarah. Let me start with you, Sarah. Explain for us what is being proposed here.
This is not totally surprising or new to people who've been following. Entergy's looking to sell the Pilgrim Power Plant along with another they own in Michigan to a company called Holtec International, which they say specializes in decommissioning. And not unexpected. While a full license transfer after a plant goes offline, like what Entergy is trying to do, is relatively new, Entergy is hoping to follow in Vermont Yankee's footsteps and get a similar deal where a special outside company will propose a cheaper and faster way to decommission. In the past, plants have sometimes or often hired consultants to help decommission the plant, but this usually the license remains with the original company. So this is kind of unusual and unprecedented.
Jeff, let me ask you about reaction around the region to this proposal.
Well, it has. Some folks are saying this is good. This is a sign of what's happening in the future. We have these aging nuclear plants. We have some energy sources that are becoming available that are more cost effective. So some experts are saying it would behoove this company, since it's such a growth market, there are so many nuclear plants going offline, to do a good job here, because it's estimated to be a $14 billion market in the next 10 years. Whereas some of the of Pilgrim's detractors are saying, well, you know what? If Entergy couldn't do it with their $1 billion in decommissioning fund, how is this company going to do it faster and within budget? Are they going to cut corners? So once again, mixed reaction here, but I found it particularly interesting and that this is such an emerging growth market, decommissioning nuclear plants.
It certainly appears to be headed that way.
Right, right.
So the idea with Holtec, this company coming in that wants to take over Pilgrim, is that they can do it cheaper than Entergy believes that they could do it, and there's $1 billion fund sitting there to be used. Is that right?
That goes as part of the sale.
Definitely. I think on the other end, I spoke with Mary Lampert yesterday. Critics are pretty worried about who's going to be held accountable if the decommissioning costs more than Holtec is proposing. Entergy has a little over $1 billion in their decommissioning fund, but they were even proposing, they said they couldn't do it, that decommissioning would be more expensive than what was in that fund.
Right.
And so it is a little worrisome, especially to critics. You know, Holtec is saying we can do this cheaper and faster. What happens if you can't? And also what gets sacrificed for that?
And then maybe there's some safety that gets sacrificed if they're trying to do it quicker and cheaper.
That's definitely what people are worried about.
Are they saying they can do it in 3 years to remove 4,000 spent fuel?
But maybe I saw, did I see 8 years somewhere?
I've been told 8 years. But still, that's much faster.
That's much faster, yeah.
Entergy had 60 years to decommission.
60 years.
Right.
So this is dramatically faster. And so it is definitely, I think, within reason to wonder, how are you going to do that? Even though you guys are maybe better, more experienced than Entergy at decommissioning, is this actually possible or is this too good to be true?
Now, this has not been signed off on yet by the Nuclear Regulatory Commission. Is that right? What's the next step as this goes forward?
So the NRC has not yet signed off on it, and they are the final approval. And it'll take about a year after they decommission in June of 2019 before the NRC makes their final decision. So it'll be 2020 by the time Holtec could take over.
And the plant, for anyone who doesn't know, is scheduled to close by end of May next year.
Mm-hmm.
We're going to speak now with Bill Evel, managing editor over at the Vineyard Gazette. Good morning, Bill.
Good morning, Steve. How you doing?
Doing well. Bill, an enormous parcel of land on the island is coming up for sale. It's a parcel with what sounds like a lot of history and environmental value as well. Tell us about this.
Well, yeah, a whole lot of history and a whole lot of acreage just came up for sale. It's the storied Mohu Estate. It's 186 acres off Lambert's Cove Road, off of the north shore of the island. It's going for sale today for $39.5
million. $39.5
million. Exactly. But that is a lot of land, and it's a beautiful spot. But it also has a huge history. Most recently, Catherine Graham, the publisher of the Washington Post for many years, she purchased the property in 1972. And upon her death, Bill Graham became the steward, her son. He died this past December. Now the land has been held in a trust, and the money from the proceeds of the sale will go to two charities. The names of those have not been disclosed yet.
The property has a lot of history involved with it, too.
Yeah, it goes way back. There, it is said that Bartholomew Gosnold, who discovered much of this area for England, of course, you know, it had been discovered before by the Wampanoags, but it's said that he may have landed there in 1602. Calvin Coolidge has vacationed there. More recently with Catherine Graham, all sorts of dignitaries have come through there. Nancy Reagan stayed there, the Clintons. And Catherine Graham herself, she vacationed there for about 30 years. Her vacation was interrupted in 1974, of course. That's when President Nixon resigned due to Watergate, much of which she had a hand in playing. But since she passed, and also during her term, the Grahams really focused on keeping up the conservation of the land, and it really is pristine. They're going to keep 50 acres still for the family, but 186 acres. It includes all these wooded trails, Lambert's Cove Beach. And the big question now is there's no conservation restrictions on the land. So who buys it and what happens to it? That's what we see, what we'll find out next.
The Grahams themselves, or Bill Graham, he played a role in conservation on the island as well, and was also part of helping the Martha's Vineyard Hospital come back from when it was struggling. Is that right?
Yes, he was a big player here, but in a quiet way. Really wonderful guy who gave a lot of money, again, quietly and anonymously, to different conservation groups. And in the 1990s, he was a big part of helping save the hospital come out of bankruptcy. So he's been an important player, even though a lot of people, you know, don't know him. So what happens to his legacy and the Grahams' legacy will be very interesting to follow.
Bill Evel of the Vineyard Gazette. Bill, thanks for speaking to us this morning.
Thank you. All right. Take care.
This is the News Roundup. I'm Steve Junker. With me in the studio, Jeff Spillane and Sarah Tan. We're going to go to the break now. There's more in a moment. Welcome back. This is the News Roundup on The Point. We're discussing the top local news stories of the week. I'm Steve Junker. Joining me from the Cape Cod Times is Jeff Spillane, and also with us is Sarah Tan, WCAI's reporter. Let's speak now about the story coming out this week, offshore wind company Vineyard Wind announcing the cost at which it's proposing to sell its electricity. This has been a big question. What's this clean energy going to cost you and me, the ratepayer? Sarah Tan, give us a quick and dirty answer. What is the cost?
Well, you as the consumer, you are probably not going to see much of a difference in your bill. According to documents released by the state on the contracts a few days back, you may see around a 20 to 40 cent savings for a $100 electricity bill, but it really isn't going to be very noticeable. But experts say that is kind of the point. Offshore wind energy has previously been priced at astronomically high rates. Cape Wind, for instance, just a few years ago, was proposing a wholesale rate of about 18 cents per kilowatt hour, which a lot of people said would have been devastating for consumers.
So that's like three times the amount that this now looks like it's going to be sold at.
Yeah, this is being priced at 6.5 cents.
Right, yeah, and just reading the great story that Marianne Bragg did here for the Times, this is signifying, really, as you just said, that now wind power is economically competitive. And from what I understand, the price that they came up with, 6.5 cents, it's called a levelized price, which is a minimum price which energy must be sold for a project to break even, which is why it was at that price.
So it's that minimum price is 6.5 cents per kilowatt hour, but consumers will pay much more than that. Mm. What are they paying when they actually pay the full cost of electricity? Is there some transportation fees on the lines?
Yeah. There are going to be transportation fees and just like processing fees that will be tacked on. So, you know, people typically pay the wholesale price of energy right now is 3 to 4 cents per kilowatt hour, but people end up paying about 14 cents per kilowatt hour in Massachusetts when all is said and done.
Mm-hmm. And what happens next with the rate proposal? Where does it go?
Experts are saying this is a pretty big step forward for the offshore wind energy to be able to competitively price this energy. So DPU is going to put the contract up for a public hearing, and then they're going to release a schedule for when they will formally approve the contract and move forward.
Let's speak now about another story. Jeff Spillane, the state appears to be close to adopting a short-term rental tax. This is for rentals like those through the website Airbnb.
Mm. Yeah, this was big news that came out of Beacon Hill this week, Steve. It was a real sprint to the finish at the end of the legislative session. Got to say, it does happen every second July, that like it's done in the last 48 hours. But the day before the end of the session, that would have been Monday, The House and Senate had approved what they call a compromise short-term rental tax bill. It had come out of the conference committee where they ironed out some of their differences. This has been brewing for years. As a matter of fact, Representative Sarah Peake from Provincetown said she's been working on something along these lines since 2002. And what had been agreed upon was a 5.7% tax on all short-term rentals.
Mm-hmm.
Those are those under 31 days, according to the bill. Now, that would put these type of rentals that have been made popular in recent years by Airbnb, Vrbo, HomeAway, on an even keel with the hotel and motel tax here. But municipalities would also have the option to add on to that 5.7%, up to 6%, or as high as 9% if the renter owned more than one property.
Mm-hmm.
And I know down here on the Cape, I saw someone comment that they own a cottage colony, so that would put them up at the 9% level. But more important for the Cape and Islands, and something that our delegation, I should note that the entire Cape and Islands delegation, all eight members, did vote for this. It was a 2.75% tax that would be put on short-term rentals for the creation and endowment of what's called the Cape and Islands Water Protection Fund, which would help the region pay for our multi-billion-dollar wastewater cleanup efforts that we're facing here in the coming years. Senator Julian Sear predicted that 2.75% for the Water Protection Fund could yield up to $20 million a year
mm-hmm.
here on the Cape and Islands to help pay for those projects, which in the long term would result in lower property taxes for people here. And some of the folks that I spoke to today said, you know, in the end, it's going to reduce our property taxes. Let's let the people who are using these resources help pay for them. Should also be noted, as part of that bill, renters would have to carry $1 million liability insurance rider. They would be placed in a statewide registry, which is would be the first in the nation to have that. And you'd have to comply with health and safety regulations, just like a hotel. So,
now you were telling me that Massachusetts is not unique in looking to tax these short-term rentals.
No, not unique at all. I spoke with the Travel Technology Association in D.C. earlier in the week. I'm going to be looking into this a little further, but the person I spoke to, who is, his title was the Vice President of Short-Term Rentals, said Massachusetts is one of the last, if not the last, state to have a tax on short-term rentals. And we took a look at the states surrounding Massachusetts. They all have one. And a matter of fact, Connecticut has the highest short-term rental tax of any state in the country.
Mm.
So a lot of people may be thinking, you know, this is unique to Massachusetts. It's not.
Now, there was a lot of momentum behind this, particularly on the Cape, because mm-hmm. it looked like it could help solve or be a piece of solving the wastewater problem. Early in the week, it looked like this might come right through the State House, and the State House has signed off on it, but the governor has not signed off on it, and he has concerns that have held this up now.
That's right. He did not sign off on it. He did return it to the legislature on Wednesday night, I believe. He wants to see an exemption for renters who only rent their properties out for 14 days or less. He would like to see some more privacy safeguards in the registry. I've been told by sources that I've spoke with in the State House, this by no means means the bill is dead. It's just a delay. But it now has to be brought up in an informal session, most likely in the next 7 to 8 days. And it's a fairly unique process in the informal session where any vote on this would have to be unanimous.
Mm.
If there's one nay vote, then it's all bets off until the next session starts in January. But Senator Sear gave me a statement yesterday saying that he's very optimistic that this is going to happen. And he says the amendments that the governor is looking for, he refers to them as modest and practical. So still hopeful.
Let's speak with Josh Balling at the Nantucket Inquirer and Mirror. Good morning, Josh.
Good morning.
Josh, island real estate is booming. Tell us about this.
It is, and island real estate has been booming for quite some time.
No surprise, yes.
Tempered, no surprise. Tempered, by the recession in 2008 and other minor blips. But real estate investment on Nantucket is an investment that mirrors the stock market and then survives better oftentimes than the stock market. And it is back and booming again. The first 6 months of the year, the second highest all-time first 6 months of a year since 2005, $492.2 million in property changed hands on Nantucket in the first 6 months of the year. And that's second only to about $530 million in 2005, when over $1.2 billion was sold over the course of the entire year. So it looks like we're on pace for another $1 billion year in Nantucket real estate. We had one last year. Island real estate brokers are optimistic. They say that the only thing that could put a damper on it is the current political and world economic climate. If protracted trade wars continue, if the stock market slips, if interest rates rise, that all has an impact on Island real estate. But right now, it's looking good. Properties are selling across all sectors. There is, of course, for those of us that live here year-round, those that work here, a little bit of a black lining in that silver cloud, if you say. Affordable housing is almost impossible to find on the island, and even the island's real estate brokers acknowledge that, and they've been acknowledging that for a while. The town is attempting to address it in various shapes and forms. There have been a couple of affordable housing projects proposed, approved, some controversial, some more controversial than others, including a current 40B that we have in the process right now that has generated quite a bit of public opposition. But even the real estate brokers say that if the prices of island real estate continue to rise, and the average home this year right now is about $2.34 million average sale price, and the median sale price is about $1.5 million, that's really going to stress the service economy, the year-round working economy that provides the services that make Nantucket such a desirable place.
Josh, there's a clothing store on Main Street that's closing after quite a long, long run. It's going to make a difference to the feeling of the center of town, I think.
It certainly is. From big business to somewhat small but long-lasting business, the Nobby Shop at the corner of Main and South Water Streets, been in business for 88 years. Sam Limparis, he's 77 now, his wife's family started the business, has decided to close in the fall. He said that it's time, he's ready to retire, but there have been changes downtown. The rents have gone up, the real estate prices have something to do with that. The internet has changed the way retail business is done, especially on Nantucket. The Nobby Shop used to be one of the only places you could go to do school shopping for your children, for men and women to get a good pair of shoes, for workers to get Carhartts and Levi's and work boots. And that's changed, and he acknowledged that, as well as downtown parking is hard to get. And so he's going to close up shop at the end of the year, or the end of the fall anyway, and put a portion of the building on the market and head into retirement. But it is going to be a difference downtown once the Nobby Shop closes up.
And elsewhere on the island, there's an erosion control project that's moving forward.
It is. Anyone who follows Nantucket News, who's listened to us discuss it in the past, knows that the Sconset Bluff is subject to erosion, and there have been plans for decades to attempt to control some of that erosion, including the current project, which is a series of geotextile tubes along the base of the bluff. And the Select Board on Wednesday night approved the Sconset Beach Preservation Fund's request to go to the Conservation Commission with a proposal to quadruple the size of that erosion control project, stretch it from about 1,000 feet to 4,000 feet. If the CONCOM approves it, it would come back to the Select Board for approval again. The Select Board has jurisdiction because a portion of the property is public property, being that it's a beach. This proposal as well has generated some controversy. A number of groups have concerns about it, including a group called the Nantucket Coastal Conservancy, which questions its effectiveness and its impact on the beach. But some independent studies that have been done and studies provided by the SBPF have shown that it doesn't appear to be much of an environmental impact, at least in the short window that the study was taken. So the Select Board said, okay, you can go ahead, go to the Conservation Commission, see what they have to say about increasing the size of this project in the hopes that it will protect the bluff, protect the homes above, and the street there, Baxter Road, which leads to Sankey Lighthouse out there in the east end of the island.
Josh Balling from the Nantucket Inquirer and Mirror. Josh, thank you for joining us this morning.
Thank you.
We're going to speak now with Ed Miller at the Provincetown Banner. Good morning, Ed.
Good morning, Steve.
Ed, something very, very rare became available in Wellfleet, so valuable that it seems the only way to handle it was to hold a lottery. Tell us about this.
That's right, Steve. This is about aquaculture in Wellfleet, which is a major industry. According to the Shellfish Department here, 15% of the full-time residents of Wellfleet are involved in harvesting shellfish in one way or another. So the aquaculture takes place on grants in Wellfleet Harbor that are managed by the town. And so people who want to get into the oyster growing business here have to lease a grant from the town. And there is a limited number of these grants. And the problem has arisen because when people decide that they don't want to farm their shellfish grants anymore, they have the right to pass them down to their children or to friends. So it's been at least 18 years since a shellfish grant in Wellfleet has actually become available from the town, and that happened this year. And the town, the selectmen, conducted a lottery to determine who would get the grant. This is a three-acre shellfish grant that is off Indian Neck in Wellfleet Harbor. And 12 local people applied, submitted applications for the lottery. They had to show that they qualified, that is, that they had sufficient experience working as shellfishermen or on other people's grants to know what they were doing. Mm-hmm. 11 of the 12 qualified. They held the lottery on June the 6th, and the lucky winner was a young man, Justin Lynch, who grew up in Wellfleet. He's in his 30s, and he's just thrilled. He has arranged to work the grant together with his friend, Eben Kenny, also a local young man in his 30s who grew up here. This is not an easy grant, according to Shellfish Constable Nancy Civetta. It's out in deep water, sort of beyond many of the other grants in that area, and it really can be accessed only at extreme low tide. Chivetta said it's going to take creativity and experimentation to make that grant work, but she thinks that Lynch and Kenny will be able to do it. They're young. They've worked other grants. They can share the investment workload and the brainstorming. It raises an interesting situation here because the two men who had this grant before, Tim Hughes and Rick Merrill, had the grant for several years. Their lease was up for renewal this year, and they decided that they had too many other things going on to keep doing it and to turn it back over to the town. And Hughes told us that he was disenchanted with the whole grant system here in Wellfleet and felt that it was unfair for people to be able to just hand these grants down to their kids or their friends, and that they ought to go back to the town and be, you know, part of a lottery. And that's exactly what they did. And the lottery that was held really shows how many young people here want to get into the aquaculture industry, mm-hmm. but they simply can't, and because there's no more room for grants in the harbor. So Civetta says, I'm inviting all shellfish grant holders who aren't making the most of their acreage to think about the next generation. She says there are 10 young people who didn't win this lottery who have the gumption and drive and means to get into shellfish farming. And she thinks that some of the grant holders who are not really using their grants as much as they could should make them available to these young people.
Ed Miller from the Provincetown Banner. Ed, thank you for joining us.
Always a pleasure, Steve.
And we are going to the break now. And when we come back, we're going to speak with Brian Dowd at the Martha's Vineyard Times. This is the News Roundup. I'm Steve Junker. There's more in a moment. Welcome back. This is the News Roundup on The Point. We're discussing the top local news stories of the week. I'm Steve Junker. Joining me from the Cape Cod Times is Jeff Spillane. And with us on the phone right now is Brian Dowd from the Martha's Vineyard Times. Good morning, Brian.
Hey, how's it going?
Brian, we talked about short-term rental tax earlier. Martha's Vineyard Times took a closer look at what that could mean for the island and the reaction there. Tell us what you found.
Sure. So as you may know, the island has lots of short-term rentals, especially in the summer season. And several of the hotel owners here had a chance to talk about the tax, which they have to pay. And they all were pretty much in agreement that it put the short-term rentals and hotels on an even playing field. And Josh Goldstein, co-owner of the Mansion House, actually said that the tax for the short-term rentals would bring in an additional revenue to the towns, which, of course, is good for, fire department, police station, all that. And an earlier version of the bill got actually mixed responses from a lot of the island public officials because they felt that the tax, which included a 2.75 tax for cleaning up nitrogen in the water on the Cape and the islands, they felt that not enough of that money was going to come back to the island. And so they kind of fought for that. And Gail Barmakian, the selectman chair from Oak Bluffs, really fought. She was one of the people that really fought for the island to have an opt-in clause for the towns so that before towns had to join and pay the tax, but now they can decide if they want to pay that.
It sounded like with some of the people that you spoke to, the people who are doing rentals on the island, that they weren't particularly concerned about this driving down business. They were just going to fold this into their costs.
Yeah, so Shelley Christensen is she's a landlord on island, and she's done rentals for years and each summer. And she said that it wasn't a big problem for her and that she was just going to set her rates like it was just a utility cost or a cleaning cost that she tax on. And so for her, it wasn't a big deal. And Laurel Schneider, who's another short-term renter, who uses VRBO, which is essentially this just like Airbnb. And she said the same thing, that I think they felt that not many people like to pay taxes, but they didn't really mind paying this.
I want to ask you about another story, Brian. Last weekend saw one of the fundraising highlights of the year with the Possible Dreams auction. This is a benefit. For folks who may not know what it's all about, set the scene and just give us a few highlights briefly of that.
Yeah, so the Martha's Vineyard Community Services has this huge auction fundraiser every year called the Possible Dreams Auction, and they kind of split it up into different sections. They have a silent, a super, and a live auction, and the live auction is kind of the big event where they have some big-ticket items that they auction off, such as paintings, rides on sailboats, and trips to other countries. And so one of the big items that they had was a trip, kind of an all-inclusive trip to France that was for 8 people. And it was really great to see people donating to that because Peter Goodell and his wife Rainey kind of got in a bidding war with Diane and Tom Keller over the trip. But then once they got to the $10,000 threshold, Peter Goodell and his wife Rainey said that they just wanted two of those 8 seats, and they'd still pay $10,000. And the Kellers agreed, and so altogether, that one trip to France got $20,000 in donations for the community services.
So a big fundraiser, and that's benefiting Martha's Vineyard Community Services. Brian Dowd from the Martha's Vineyard Times. Brian, thanks for joining us this morning.
Yeah, of course. Thank you.
With me in the studio is Jeff Spillane from the Cape Cod Times. Jeff, there was a terrible car accident last weekend killing 3 people, including a young man who was a new father. Now, the Mashpee police are conducting an internal investigation about the car chase that appears to have led up to the accident.
Yeah, they are. They are, Steve. And this happened just hours after the shooting of the 2 police officers in Falmouth. So, unbelievable week here. The accident happened early Saturday morning, and it did start with a police pursuit heading east of Route 28 from Mashpee, crossed into the Barnstable, over the Barnstable line into Kootuat. On Wednesday, Scott Carline, who's the chief of police in Mashpee, announced that there would be an internal investigation open regarding this and whether or not the chase was in accordance with department policy for pursuits. We also learned today, and it's in the Cape Cod Times today, that it will be an internal investigation. The police officer claimed that he was up this Mickey Rivera was operating erratically, speeding, had some Mark Lanes violation and some stop sign violations. And at one point, he was going 65 miles an hour passing cars in a 35-mile-hour zone. Anyway, the policy here in Mashpee is that officers may continue pursuing the subject into another jurisdiction as long as they conform to the State Department and interjurisdictional agreements regarding chases. They're supposed to terminate the chase if it becomes evident that there's a risk to life and property, and that would outweigh the benefit derived from apprehending the subject. And also, if they're chasing someone for something like a motor vehicle violation or a misdemeanor or a nonviolent felony, or they actually know who it is, so mm-hmm. maybe go apprehend them later, then they could terminate the chase. So that is where that stands. It should also be noted that this Mickey Rivera, he also died in the crash, 22 years old from Fall River. At the time, he was on a GPS monitoring system. Ironically, he was supposed to be in the Fall River District Court this week for a hearing about an armed assault he was involved in relation to a murder in Fall River. A lot of questions, a lot of controversy over why this man was out on the streets. Mm-hmm. He had a $35,000 bail. It was reduced to $1,000. And to add on to that issue, which was going on in Bristol County, we learned this week that just in June, he was arrested in Barnstable for operating under the influence of drugs, negligent operation of vehicle, and a Mark Lanes violation, but was released. Mm. According to Michael O'Keefe, the district attorney here in Barnstable County, he came out and said, you know, the prosecutor was only on the job for 1 month, and, you know, in hindsight, should have asked for the bail to be revoked. So, this is incredible.
This crash happened at such a high speed that one of the cars was ripped in half. It's just
split in two.
Terrible. Yeah. So I want to take a moment to talk about the young Mashpee man who was killed in this accident. He was a former Marine. Mm-hmm. His wife had just given birth to a daughter a couple of days earlier.
Yeah, and you know, I live in Mashpee, and the entire community is heartbroken, just tragic beyond sad, Steve. Not only has it dominated the headlines here, it's actually become national news. Kevin Quinn, he was 32 years old, lived in Mashpee, well-known, well-loved in the community, operated a septic and excavation company, which, as you mentioned, a former Marine, served two tours. But one thing that people are just finding beyond words is he was on his way home from Cape Cod Hospital visiting his little girl who had just been born 2 days before. Mm. He was going home to get some sleep, was heading back to the hospital in the morning to bring his wife and daughter home. The community has really rallied for this family. As of last night, the GoFundMe campaign to help the family was getting close to $300,000. Mm. And there are more events being held in Mashpee this weekend, drives for baby goods, etc. Kevin Quinn, visiting hours will be Sunday. The funeral is supposed to be 11 o'clock at Monday. And there is an appeal being made to folks in town to line Route 151 after the funeral procession leaves the church, line it all the way down to the exit at Route 28 as it heads to the National Cemetery. Incredible tragedy.
We're going to speak now with Andy Tomolonis at SouthCoastToday.com and New Bedford Standard Times. Good morning, Andy.
Hey, Steve.
Andy, the city of New Bedford will be able to develop part of the state pier for mixed use. This is a big win for the city, and it was not easy to get it, it sounds like.
Yes. So on the surface, you know, it doesn't sound like it's a very big deal. As one of the final acts of the legislative session on Tuesday night, there was language that was inserted into the $600 million economic development bond. And it allows for mixed-use development on a section of State Pier, which is smack dab in the middle of New Bedford's working waterfront. So the language also transfers control of State Pier from the State Department of Conservation and Recreation to Mass Development. And this is a big deal for New Bedford, and it completes a vision that planners have seen for connecting the city's downtown area and the national parks area to the working waterfront. So State Senator Mark Montigny has long been a champion of the cause, and he helped push language through. But what it means is that retail shops, restaurants, and other uses are now a possibility along that section of State Pier, and that sits right closest to the downtown area. And there are already some restaurants along New Bedford's waterfront near the downtown. There's the Black Whale, the Waterfront Grill, Ice Cream Stand, and others. Those are along the piers that are under the city's control. But for a long time, there's been a sticking point, you know, with New Bedford getting control or having development, you know, sort of the worries that the working waterfront will be, you know, too much gentrified and made into a tourist attraction.
Mm-hmm.
But there's a big area of State Pier that's really not used, and it's closest to, you know, closest to the downtown. So State Pier is the big city, the big pier right in the center of action in the city, and it's where the Sea Street, the ferry docks, it's where these small cruise ships come in, and it's also a spot where big freighters come in and offload fruit, I think clementines and tangerines and oranges that are shipped elsewhere, you know, mostly to Canada and to the north. And a few years ago, it's where the tall ship Charles Morgan docked. So it's a great deal for the city to open this area up to, you know, to visitors. And you mentioned that there was some controversy getting it done. You know, a lot of lawmakers didn't want to yield control of the pier. And it does cost a lot to maintain and repair the facilities, pilings and the foundations and all of that. So that's still under state control. And it still has a lot of potential as a marine commerce hub. There's refrigerator units that were put to the site, and you know, so there's a lot that's gone on there to develop the marine business use. I should stop and clarify that the State Pier, if you know about New Bedford, it's not the marine commerce terminal. That's farther south. So the Marine Commerce Terminal is the new facility that's going to be a staging area for the offshore wind mm-hmm. industry. Yeah, you might have heard a lot about that. This area is more centrally located. It really is right across the street from the main intersection in the downtown area. So it's more conducive to mixed use. There's a section of the property that isn't really being used. And it's close to that waterfront access road, MacArthur Drive. And it really is would be a good transition area from the waterfront to the downtown. And, you know, we recently had renovations on Route 18 to make it more pedestrian friendly. And so this fits into the longer term plan. And the vision is that there's shops and restaurants and tourist attractions. If they got into that location, visitors using the ferry and other places, would they have an incentive to venture to those shops or restaurants, and then especially beyond them and into the downtown mm-hmm. area? So, you know, what happens next? The Department of Conservation and Resources, which is really not a great, you know, state department to be in control of a commercial facility like State Pier. They're working out a long-term lease at 35 years, I think, with Mass Development. And Mass Development has the expertise, the financial, you know, incentives and all of that to really conduct some smart management and development at the site. So Mass Development will be allowed to sublease areas mm-hmm. to private developers and sort of really orchestrate controlled, thoughtful development. But that, you know, that could take 6 months or so, I've been told, before the lease is worked out. And then, you know, maybe there'll be a study after that and more. So it's not like there's going to be development going on there tomorrow, but it opens the door and to some smart planning. And then it's a big deal for New Bedford.
Andy Tomolonis at SouthCoastToday.com. Andy, thanks for joining us.
Okay, thank you.
Jeff Spillane from the Cape Cod Times is with me in the studio. Jeff, Barnstable County is looking for proposals from people who might want to lease portions of a 96-acre farm property.
That's right. If you have a green thumb, this is a good opportunity for you. Last summer, the Massachusetts State Auditor's Office issued a report. They did an audit of the finances of the county, and it uncovered that there were some improper leasing practices that had caused the county a loss of a lot of income over the years. They found there were 7 tenants occupying properties with no leases and paying no rent. One of them was here at the county farm, which is right on 6A in Barnstable Village. It currently operates as a Cape Cod organic farm. And when it was first leased 10 years ago to this Timothy Fiery, who owns the farm, in exchange for some improvements he was going to be making to the farm stand and some of the poultry cages, he did that in exchange for rent.
Mm-hmm.
Well, apparently the county has heard loud and clear what the state auditor is saying to try to fix some of these up. And the lease for the organic farm is going to be up in February. They have issued an RFP, request for proposal, for anyone who's interested in leasing the property, which includes 18 acres of fields, 4 greenhouses, and 7 buildings, including a farm stand, some poultry buildings, office, and storage. Due September 6th, if you are interested. Leo Kakunis, he's a farmer by trade himself. He's the chairman of the Barnesville County Commissioners. I asked him, how much would you like to see the county receive for this? Doesn't know, and nor does Jack Units, who's the county administrator, because as they said to me, unlike, for instance, a lawyer who may know exactly how much he or she is going to pull in for a year, a farmer can never really tell what they're going to do. So Kakunis told me that as far as the proposals, the proposed use of the property is going to really weigh heavily here. And he said, for instance, if there's an educational component, and as he put it, having the farm have regular programs to show children where food comes from, or, for instance, any other type of program that would involve the community, that probably is going to be a big plus. And who gets the lease? So, but if you are going to fill out that proposal for the entire parcel or parts of it, you need to submit a business plan and show that you have the finances to see it through.
Last week, we spoke about Judge Gary Nickerson retiring from Barnstable Superior Court after 20 years. This week, the governor nominated someone to take his place on the bench.
Yeah, and he didn't have to look far, Steve. He has suggested longtime Barnstable Superior Court judge, longtime court administrator and first assistant clerk magistrate Thomas Perino. He lives in South Dennis. He's been with the court over there in Barnstable for quite a while. It now goes to the governor's council for advice and consent. And that's an 8-member board, elected board that approves gubernatorial appointments. And Perino, he is a former president of the Barnstable County Bar Association, had been in private practice for 25 years. And currently in his position, he's responsible for maintaining court records, running civil and criminal sessions, and managing court staff in Barnstable.
I want to mention briefly the effort to bring a YMCA pool to Falmouth, which appears to be moving closer to reality.
Yeah, it took a big step ahead this week. The YMCA Cape Cod and a group called Falmouth Aquatics. It's a nonprofit that was established to create an aquatics and wellness center here in the Upper Cape. They signed a memorandum of understanding this week to collaborate on bringing a YMCA facility to Falmouth. This has been going on now for at least 5 years. The YMCA Cape Cod will take the lead in establishing the branch in Falmouth, but the folks at Falmouth Aquatics are going to get 3 dedicated seats on the YMCA board. So this facility is going to be serving Falmouth, Mashpee, Bourne, and Sandwich. And it's going to come with a price tag. They're going to say it's got about $1.5 to $2 million per year to operate.
Mm.
But moving forward.
You know, anyone following the news this summer knows there have been a number of drownings. Cape Cod Times has an article highlighting the efforts of public safety officials to call attention to the risks behind these drownings.
Yeah, 5 drownings here on the Cape and Islands just in July. A couple in Bourne. We had the woman in Nantucket swimming from her sailboat, East Ham, Dennis. And so we don't know, why. Well, of course, cardiac events did come into play here, and that's something we expect. Could it be that there are more people headed to the beach? It's been a hot and sunny summer, and many towns are seeing increases in sticker demand, a lot more people going to the beach. That could be part of it, but Cynthia McCormick, our reporter who looked into this, is saying, hey, some of them might, some of the experts she spoke to said some of them might have been bad decisions. If people were swimming where they shouldn't have been, not dedicated swim areas, and especially where there are strong currents. So really keep an eye on where you're planning on swimming. Also, if you're swimming somewhere with a lifeguard, don't assume that you and or the people you're with are necessarily safe. A doctor at Falmouth Hospital said you really got to pay attention because drowning is silent. You're not going to hear a lot of yelling or hands waving in the air. In about 15 to 20 seconds, you can go under. So always be acutely aware of your surroundings and stay away from drugs, alcohol, and don't get dehydrated when you're swimming.
That is our news roundup for the week. I want to thank my guest, Jeff Spillane, here from the Cape Cod Times, ending with some good advice there.
There you go.
And thank you to all our other contributors. I'm Steve Junker. Thank you for listening.